Now, the next case is 12-2006, State of Ohio versus Mr. Bondurant, Zachary Bondurant. Ms. Mahosik?
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, my name is Kelly Mahosik, and I represent defendant appellant Zachary Bondurant. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The plain language of the statute prohibits courts from allowing the aggregation of co-defendant's predicate acts to equal the monetary threshold found in the definition of corrupt activities. The plain language of the substantive violation is set forth in section 29.23.32a1, and it states that no person shall participate or conduct corrupt activities. The definition of corrupt activities is found in 29.23 I2C, and it has two components. It requires a person commit two predicate acts, and that person satisfy the $500 threshold. When that definition is plugged in to the substantive violation, that's how we know that that statute requires an individual's buy-in of $500. This is a logical interpretation of the statute. A person that's convicted of engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity faces the possibility of an 11-year additional sentence. That's 11 years on top of the sentence that he or she receives for the predicate acts. In this case, Mr. Bondurant was convicted of 3 counts of trafficking in drugs, which he received 17-month sentences for, and then the court imposed an additional 7 years on top of that for engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity. Because that's a substantial sentence and because people face the risk of increased penalties, the legislature wanted a nominal buy-in, a paltry sum of $500.
Now, how does the $500 work? Walk us through your take on the definition, the threshold.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not $500 of profit, right? It's $500 of transactions.
Correct. It's a monetary value of $500 placed on the predicate acts, whether it's contraband received or sold, as long as that defendant's participation equals $500. And so any combinations of violations is talking about that defendant's predicate acts.
So if they were stealing bricks.
Correct. And then
they have to steal 2 piles of bricks and they have to add up to more than $500.
Correct. Further evidence that the legislature wasn't intending to capture everybody when it imposed that financial minimum is found in the recent amendments from House Bill 86. In House Bill 86, the legislature raised the minimum from $500 to $1,000. Obviously, the legislature did not intend for everybody to be captured.
Does that seem to track the changes in penalty for theft offenses?
It does. But it also shows, though, there's no reason why the legislature had to have a minimum at all. That the federal RICO, which I'm not an expert on, doesn't have.
Was the minimum in the original RICO statute enacted back in the early 80s?
The state RICO?
Yes.
Yes, as far as I know. And so there's always been the $500.
Well, do you know or don't you?
I don't know for absolute certainty.
All right. Better answer.
Counsel, I wonder if you could address the conspiracy claim. What the state argues in their brief in response to your brief is, well, we have complicity here, we have conspiring to engage here, so why do we not look at the whole umbrella of the enterprise because this defendant was conspiring to engage or at least was complicit? Can you address that question?
Yes, there's several parts to that question. First of all, the predicate acts are essential elements of an offense for engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity. For that reason, those predicate acts have to be proven to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant also is required to receive notice of them. That means it's either got to be contained in the indictment or a bill of particulars. And so in this case, there was no conspiracy or complicity charges that were argued or instructed to the jury. It wasn't contained in the indictment. So there's no basis to find that Mr. Bondurant was complicit or conspired to commit any predicate acts or the overarching pattern of corrupt activity. But addressing conspiracy in other cases, there's two types of conspiracy. There's conspiracy to engage in the pattern of corrupt activity, the substantive violation, in which case that has to be charged separately as conspiracy to engage. There's also conspiracy to engage in the predicate acts underlying the engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity. And in that case, it's a matter of notice stating in the indictment what those predicate acts are and that those predicate acts be proven to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And here, because the state limited its theory to the three February 3rd, February 4th, and February 5th are the only offenses that relate to Mr. Bondurant, because the state limited its case to those three, and that's what the jury was instructed on, that's what was contained in the indictment, this court and the trial court wasn't allowed to look at other potential circumstantial evidence that he may have been involved in other areas of corrupt activity or other amounts that may have made up the shortfall.
Thank you.
This court's precedent.
Counsel, if I may, I'm over here.
I'm sorry.
To your right, it's okay. You started your argument with that the statute is clear on its face. Therefore, you are not arguing that the statute is ambiguous?
The statute is clear on its face that no person shall engage in corrupt activity.
I understand. I've got the statute in front of me, but I don't see where, when it starts talking about the combination of activities, I'm not sure what that means.
And in that case, if this court were to rule that the definition can't be merely plugged in based on the plain language, if for some reason this court said that when we look at the definition, it becomes ambiguous, I think Mr. Bondurant still wins his case because the rule of lenity applies. There's also concerns about the constitutional validity, such as your earlier examples about the 10-year-old that sells $25 worth of drugs. I thought of it in context of, well, what about a college student that engages in two transactions of marijuana? He's obviously acting on behalf of a supplier, so there's our enterprise, but he doesn't know other potential suppliers, who those co-defendants may be, and now he's guilty of engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity and is going to be sent to prison for...
Does he have to know?
There's no requirement that
he
know.
Why'd you bring that up? He doesn't know. So what?
There's a notice requirement. Due process requires notice. A person needs to know that their conduct violates the law before he or she can be charged with that an offense. And so what is happening is, if this court were to interpret any combinations of violations to mean that a defendant need not be responsible for $500 in sales, then any combinations of violations put every drug dealer is now guilty of engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity, regardless of whether or not they know the size of the enterprise, whether or not they know there are other people acting as drug dealers. This court's precedent in Schlosser also supports a plain reading of the statute. In that case, this court determined that engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity is a strict liability offense. It reached that conclusion by relying on the fact that the mens rea for the predicate acts shows the defendant's personal participation in those acts, because he or she acted with the requisite mental state that the strict liability can be imposed. That shows that personal participation is a requirement in order to find a defendant guilty of engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity.
Was money that your client obtained from the transaction of the sale found when the kingpin was arrested?
Yes, there was.
Could you address that as to how it yes. interfaces with your argument?
There is. There was, I think, $100 related to the February 4th transaction found in Roger Cassell's car. This, again, goes back to the predicate acts being proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That may be some evidence that Mr. Bondurant was tied to the greater enterprise, but it doesn't show that Mr. Bondurant was responsible for $36,000 in contraband.
But doesn't that show the nature or the breadth of the enterprise that he was tied to?
Yes, it does. And there's no dispute about that. But at the same time,
wait a minute. Did you say there's no dispute that he was tied to the criminal enterprise? Or did I not understand your statement?
Mr. Bondurant isn't challenging that there was a criminal enterprise in this case. What he's challenging is his role in the enterprise wasn't sufficient to impose criminal liability for engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity.
Well, you just told us, I think, that $100 of the sales that he undertook was found in the automobile, was it?
Roger Cassell's car.
Roger Cassell's vehicle.
Correct. That doesn't make Mr. Bondurant responsible for $36,000.
But it shows that he's part of that enterprise, does it not?
It shows that, what it shows is that $100 that Mr. Bondurant had was given to Roger Cassell. It might be circumstantial evidence that Mr. Bondurant was affiliated with an enterprise that did $36,000 in drug sales, but that doesn't mean that his two predicate acts equaled or exceeded $500.
Well, that would be a reasonable inference that a trier of fact could draw as to the level of his involvement in the criminal enterprise. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
And that is a reasonable inference that was made?
No.
Oh, it wasn't?
No, it wasn't made. Because there's a requirement that a defendant receive notice of his predicate acts. It's got to either be in the indictment or in the bill of particulars, and then it needs to be tried to the jury. The jury has to find that defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of his predicate acts because it's an essential element of engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity.
Counsel, did the jury actually find a specific sum that your client was participating in?
The jury was told that Mr. Bondurant participated in $460 worth of activities. That was the state's theory, the state's arguments. And then it was instructed that before it could find either respective defendant guilty of engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity, it had to find that defendant guilty of at least two of the offenses charged in the indictment, and then it could aggregate those offenses. In this case, in the indictment, Mr. Bondurant was charged with, I believe it's counts 49 through 50, and those are the only counts that, along with count one, which was the engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity offense, those were the only counts associated with Mr. Bondurant, and those were all from February 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
And added up, they were under the $500 threshold.
Correct.
Okay. But the jury was never asked to specifically put in the verdict form the actual amounts.
No, it was not. But the jury was told, the state argued, that Mr. Bondurant was responsible for $460. There's never been any dispute along the way that the transactions from February 3rd, 4th, and 5th were for $460. If this court has no further questions, we would ask that Mr. Bondurant's conviction for engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity be vacated, and that this court rule that the predicate acts of co-defendants may not be aggregated to satisfy the financial threshold in the definition of corrupt activity. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. Again, I'm Annika Collins, the Highland County Prosecutor, with my Assistant Prosecutor, Molly Bullock. A few things I want to note is it's not entirely true that the state argued the $460 and was fine with that. Actually, I argued at length that Mr. Bondurant was also involved in the $36,000 that was found in the trunk of the 2006 Jaguar owned by Roger Cassell in a storage unit in Clinton County.
Was he indicted with that specifically?
Under the RICO.
Right, but you heard counsel talk about the charges that were indicted with him specifically. Would you agree that those added up to $460?
Those predicate offenses?
Those
trafficking charges? Yes, I would agree with that. But I would argue, and I think this is the crux of this case, it's the work of the enterprise. That's why there's a separate charge. It's the work of the enterprise that you overcome, that must overcome the $500, if it even has to do with drugs, which I still question if it's not related to a property crime. But it's the work of the enterprise. That's why it's a separate charge. And the enterprise was well over $500.
As I understand it, the money found in the Jaguar was $36,000 in cash, correct?
That's correct.
So Mr. Bondurant had some wealthy friends, we could say that, can we not?
Very wealthy.
Wouldn't it be different if it was $36,000 worth of drugs?
No, it would not, because if we read the statute to include drugs, not just property crimes, it says the value of contraband. It doesn't just say the value of money found. It says that the court consider the value of contraband.
And in this context, therefore, is $36,000 contraband?
Yes, because it was made in the selling of drugs. There was also well over
Money is contraband?
If it's used in the commission of a crime or made from the commission of a crime, I think that argument could be made. But beyond that, there were drugs. There were over 17 grams of heroin. There was over 17 grams of heroin found. And that was after, again, the idea that there were three drug transactions here and that's the limit of Mr. Bondrant's involvement is just not true. There was testimony from Melinda Stewart and Megan Butcher that he came to the home to their home. Roger Castle gave him drugs on several occasions. He brought money back to Roger Castle. This would comport with the idea that he was part and parcel of $36,000 that was found in the trunk of the Jaguar. There was also testimony.
How many people did you demonstrate were, I hate to use this small fish analogy, but let's go with it. How many small fish were there? 10 or 100?
Neither. There were only 9 people involved in the enterprise altogether. Okay. So I would say that Mr. Castle, clearly the kingpin, Jeffrey Stevens, the trial court found, and I tended to agree, was his right-hand man and near the top. Megan Butcher and Melinda Stewart were somewhat of middlemen or middle women, so to speak.
Mr. Stevens was at the top?
Yes.
And his involvement was under $500?
His involvement monetarily was under $500. I mean, we could put $500 worth of cash in his hand from drug transactions, but he furthered the enterprise more than $500. He ordered Melinda and Megan to bring drugs back from Dayton, which they then gave to Mr. Bondrant.
If I understood Ms. Mohosik's argument, she alleges that the definition or the threshold for a pattern of corrupt activity is to have two predicate acts and satisfy a threshold of 500. And her argument is there were only 3 sales that the state focused on and they only totaled aggregate of 460, so the state failed to meet the $500 threshold. I think that's the argument she's advancing to.
That is the argument.
What is your response to that specific argument?
My argument is the statute does not refer to a single person, but to the enterprise. And an enterprise is defined in the statute under 292331 as a group of persons.
Okay, I understand that, but you just told us that you can put more than $500 in Mr. Bondrant's hands.
Because other witnesses testified at trial that he took on an ounce of drugs the day that they were, the day that this was in, that this was busted, so to speak, the last day of the enterprise, the day that the enterprise was stopped, he took over an ounce of heroin from Megan Butcher and Melinda Stewart, which is worth well more than the $40 that's missing if you take the 460 from 500.
Counsel, I've forgotten now whether I asked you if you knew whether there was a dollar amount in the original.
You did and I don't.
Okay. I'm still trying to get my mind around that. What would be the purpose of having that low a threshold for an overall RICO enterprise? I mean, I'm thinking back to a case we had some time ago where some lady is selling knockoff purses in homes. So they have these parties like cosmetic folks have. Even that would get above $500 for the enterprise.
Again, it's very, very simple. If you're not above 500 or now 1,000 in a property crime, you don't have a felony. So you would have a misdemeanor. Therefore, you wouldn't have a RICO, or your RICO would be in an F3 rather than an F2 or F1. It's that, to me, makes perfect sense, and I made that argument to the trial court. I think that this being related, the $500 being related to property crime makes more sense than it does to drugs every day. It just doesn't make sense to go with drugs.
Someone asked, I'm not sure that I understand the purpose of any dollar threshold.
Because if not, it doesn't reach the threshold of a felony. And therefore, you don't have an engaging in a pattern of crypto activity. Under a property crime, it has to be that dollar amount to be a felony. $1,000 now under House Bill 86 in order for it to be a felony. Otherwise, it's a misdemeanor.
Counsel, we're talking about the sentence enhancement of the RICO statute, aren't we? The idea of a defendant knowing exactly what activity is prohibited, we're not talking about allowing individuals to escape from responsibility for drug dealing and for felony level activity, felony fives or whatever. We're talking about an additional enhancement for the participation in a RICO enterprise. Should we be looking at the statute differently than any other criminal statute?
Well, here's something that's truly scary for a prosecutor. If you look at the statute and decide that now each person, each member has to have $1,000 worth of transactions involved in the enterprise, and let's say that it is a drug situation like what we had in Highland County, and again, a tenth of a gram or a half a gram, a tenth of a gram at $40 a tenth, 25 separate drug transactions in order to meet the $1,000 threshold. Now, if we don't get that far, and so Jeffrey Stevens or Zachary Bondurant is charged with 10 F5s and 3 F4s, which is much more than they were charged with, under House Bill 86, we can't even send them to prison. There has to be some bite in this. That is what the statute was made for. And the court has addressed that in Schlosser. The court said Ohio's RICO statute is the toughest. And it has to be. That's why it's for the public good. It's to quell this kind of criminal activity. It should be that.
Counsel, that was going to be my next question, was what happens to prosecutions if we were to accept appellant's reading of the statute? Could a prosecutor charge each defendant differently? And so you might have an individual trafficking charge, but you could also have conspiring to engage in all the other trafficking charges. Would that be what you'd have to do in your indictments then?
I'm not even sure that would work. And even then, why not just charge the RICO? I mean, that the RICO basically says that you've conspired to further this whole enterprise, this group of persons. And why not read it to say it's the enterprise, the group of people that are involved in two or more transactions? That's how you establish a pattern. And it's this group of people, the enterprise, that reaches the $500, now $1,000 threshold.
But you said, why not read it in favor of the state? We have another statute that says if there's some confusion, we read it in favor of the defense, not the state.
Absolutely. Unless reading it in favor of the defense forces you to narrowly read the statute and completely throw out the legislative intent. As this court held.
You keep saying legislative intent, but as Justice Pfeiffer pointed out, it's the language of the statute that we have to look at, not what we perceive was the reason for the statute. If we are incorrect, it can be amended to correct what the legislature wants.
That's not what this court held in State v. White. In State v. White, the court held, and Justice Lundberg Stratton noted, that 2901.04 does require a reviewing court to strictly construe a criminal statute against the state unless reading the statute like that would defeat the legislative intent. And the legislative intent here was to capture the smallest fish in the sea.
Well, not counsel. I've heard that several times. I try to avoid this, but I was there at the time. I think I sponsored the bill. And I don't recall.
What did you mean?
This discussion at all about the dollar amount. I don't even recall a dollar amount being in the bill, so I'm of no help to anybody on this panel with respect to that. What I do recall is a lot of time spent on this. I do recall, as was stated, patterned after the federal legislation. Mm-hmm. Professor Blakely from Notre Dame I invited in a couple times. He had staffed the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee when they wrote the Federal Act, and then he came in and provided advice to the Ohio legislature on this. But I think we're really stuck with trying to read the language and figuring out what's the right answer here. We can talk all day long about legislative intent, but I think we have to do what we always do, and that is look at the statute and figure out what's the right answer to a question that quite probably the General Assembly never even anticipated this argument.
Well, if you don't remember the monetary balance being discussed in 1985, that gives me hope that it's property related, because I believe in 1985, your level of offense got higher depending on how many prior offenses you committed, right, not on the monetary value. So the monetary value is added when property crimes became set based on the monetary value. That supports my reading of the statute to begin with, which is the reason this is in here is to get it to a felony for property crimes. Justices, I would just ask you to think about the following things when you make your decisions. As you've talked about in other scenarios, the driver of the getaway car in a robbery case who never actually exits the car is found guilty of murder if the person in the convenience store shoots the clerk just as if he or she were in that convenience store. The same is to be said for the enterprise. Additionally, the RICO statute was designed to impose cumulative liability for the criminal enterprise. It's not a stretch of the statute to accumulate actions and finances for the enterprise, and the court held that in State v. Schlosser. And finally, to hold that only those actors transacting more than $500 or $1,000 be guilty of crimes of the enterprise would allow those who commit violent crimes on behalf of the enterprise and never touch a dollar to walk away with a misdemeanor assault or an aggravated assault charge. Maybe the enforcer who and the Fourth District Court of Appeals appreciated this argument, the enforcer who goes and punches somebody in the jaw because he hasn't paid for his drugs, but that person never actually gets money and you know doesn't handle any drugs, they are an enforcer. Should they not be punished with the enterprise? I absolutely think that they should be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've a little under 3 minutes. What happens, counsel, if the original legislation was silent as to a dollar amount and it was only added when it became a theft offense was related to a dollar amount?
Then that the statute has to be read and interpreted as written, and it says that any combinations of violations must equal $500. And when that's read in conjunction with no person shall engage in a pattern of activity.
So it's not so unambiguous then in your mind if that's the history on this?
No, and in fact, it supports our position because it shows that the legislature didn't want to capture everybody under every circumstance, that there are actual buy-in requirements before they wanted to hold people personally responsible for their participation in the corrupt activities.
Well, what about the last example that was given by the prosecutor, that if there is someone who is the muscle or the enforcer in this enterprise and is inflicting bodily harm but not conducting sales?
Mr. Bondurant was convicted under 29, 23, 32, A1, and then also with the definition as provided for corrupt activities as set forth in I2C, and those offenses are compelling prostitution, promoting prostitution, disseminating matter harmful to a juvenile. There's no provision in there for that allows the predicate act to be threatening somebody. So that doesn't apply. That person would have to be charged differently. It may be in that case that defendant has to be charged with the predicate act of conspiring to sell drugs or collect a debt of some sort, but it couldn't be charged just flat out in I2C anyway. I see you furrowing your eyebrows. I want to make sure. Okay.
I'm looking at the statute here because
too much into that.
$500 has to be given meaning. The prosecutor's position essentially reads out that baseline minimum requirement. This isn't putting an incredibly onerous burden on prosecutors in pursuing cases against people that are engaged in illegal activities.
Counsel, is it normal to see RICO brought along with the drug charges, or is this a bit unusual?
It's my understanding that's becoming more and more common. I can't speak statistically, but that more often now drug transactions, drug rings are being used and charged under the RICO statute. But the defendant in those cases can still be charged with the predicate acts. Moreover,
we understand that, and it seems to me perhaps part of it is a philosophical argument about perhaps a sea change by prosecutors in terms of how they approach these drug cases. That the RICO statute is pretty complicated, and so it just remained on the shelf with the other law books, and at some point some prosecutor or prosecutors, perhaps this prosecutor was the pioneer, decided, hey, this is a useful tool.
And it would still be a useful tool even if there is this minimum buy-in requirement for personal participation. Mr. Bondurant may have been able to be charged with conspiracy to engage in other activities associated with the enterprise. The prosecutor didn't proceed that way. He wasn't indicted that way, and that's not the theory that the prosecutor pursued throughout the case, and that's not what he was convicted of beyond a reasonable doubt. It may be a matter of setting forth fully what instances underlie the engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity charge, and that is required by due process.
Counsel, I guess that you've just raised a new question in my mind. I'm sorry to be late on this, but if we accept the aggregate definition, therefore, organized crime in Ohio starts at $500. If there's 10 kids who do $50 worth, we have organized crime, correct?
Organized crime doesn't start at $10. The risk of facing, I'm sorry, $500. The risk of facing a substantial.
I'm addressing Justice Pfeiffer early. Why $500? If we take the aggregate right now, organized crime starts at $500.
Punishment, the facing the risk of an 11-year sentence starts at $500. Those defendants can still be charged with the predicate acts.
I understand that.
So, which is still a substantial sentence. Those are still offenses that, like in this case, that resulted in 17 months per charge. That's no short sentence. But before the legislature chose to impose the risk of these really significant sentences, which is either for F2s or F1s, depending on the other underlying offenses, it said, we want a buy-in. We want somebody to be responsible for at least $500 in activities before they go away to prison for 11 years.
No, I understand. Maybe I'm not artfully asking the question, but if 10 kids got together and each sold $50 worth of drugs, mm-hmm. are they therefore eligible to be charged under RICO if we go with the aggregate theory?
Under the aggregate theory, yes. But that is in contravention of the plain reading of the statute, which says we don't punish people for engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity unless his or her participation in the enterprise's activities amounts to at least $500.
And to be clearer, though, what you said earlier was they could be charged differently.
Yes. That nothing if the state wanted to pursue a conspiracy or a complicity charge and say that, and if those defendants, those co-defendants knew that the other people were engaging in these drug deals, I don't see what would prevent them from being charged with complicity to engage in a pattern of corrupt activity. But that's not what happened here. That Mr. Bondurant was never indicted for knowing what Mr. Stevens did or doing acts in furtherance of that, or vice versa. That's not the theory of the case. That's not what the indictment said. That's not what was presented to the jury, and that's not what he was convicted of. If this court has no further questions, again, I would just reiterate, we'd ask that this court rule that the offenses of co-defendants may not be aggregated to satisfy the monetary threshold.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.